From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For decades now, the West has had high hopes that Russia would see the light, that its political leaders would put aside the remnants of an oppressive past and adopt the characteristics of freedom and democracy. But a new film for the PBS program Frontline raises a troubling question. What if Russia isn't actually capable of being democratic? As one Russia expert puts it in the film, Russia isn't a democracy in the process of failing. It's an authoritarian system in the process of succeeding. And that question is personified in the character of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The film examines Putin's rise to power and uncovers some disturbing questions from his past, stories about corruption and crime that reflect his place in Russian culture. The film is called Putin's Way. We'll talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The investigative reporter Gillian Findley's film for the PBS program Frontline is, in some ways, a profile of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Findley has talked to scholars and Russian activists and journalists, even exiled business tycoons. The idea was to give some context for Putin's extraordinary rise to power. The film, which airs tonight on PBS stations around the country, examines some disturbing stories from Putin's past. And these are serious charges about alleged money laundering activities, possible affiliations with organized crime. Questions are raised about whether Putin has a secret personal fortune in the tens of billions. But the film is also an exploration of where Putin fits in a larger culture. It's a profile of a people who have been through their share of political and social turmoil. The documentary is called Putin's Way. And today in the program, Gillian Findley is joining us to talk about it. Gillian Findley is a journalist who hosts and reports for the CBC investigative program, The Fifth Estate. She is a correspondent on this new Frontline documentary, which is a co-production, we should mention, with the CBC. The film premieres tonight on KUED Channel 7 here in Utah and on public stations, as I said, around the country. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Gillian Findley is joining us today from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. And Gillian Findley, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I guess I want to begin with, we should mention that you you spent time, of course, covering the collapsing Soviet Union. This was in the 90s. You were a correspondent there, of course. And I'm wondering what your reflections on what you were seeing there, how much that has influenced these questions that you've been raising in your investigation.
That's interesting. I was a resident correspondent in Moscow in the mid to late 90s. I worked for ABC television at that time. And it was interesting because those were the last days of Boris Yeltsin's presidency. I left for a new posting before that election in which he was ultimately replaced by Vladimir Putin. But I was sent back in a couple of times for just a variety of reasons. And one of the very last story I filed at that point was about the apartment building bombings that we go into in some detail in the documentary tonight. So it was very interesting for me to go back these, 15 years later and to understand how many questions there still are about those bombings and who was responsible. There were rumors at the time. There were suspicions at the time. Nobody really seemed to know. And then, of course, became a pretext for an invasion of Chechnya, and that then dominated the second war in Chechnya. Then dominated all the news coming out of that part of the world. And so, to go back 15 years later and understand that the suspicions are even more valid now than they probably were even then was quite interesting.
Are you surprised by because you've mentioned that in many ways? We know very little about Putin's rise to power. I mean, that seems like something you were interested in getting at.
Absolutely. It was kind of shocking to me when we first started musing about this story. to realize that he's actually been in power for a decade and a half in Russia, and yet we really don't know very much about him. And because of his activities into, you know, some of neighboring territories now, he has become, you know, much more back on our radar screen. But so we really did go in saying, well, let's go back and let's really understand the story. And where did he come from? And what was his training? And what was his political philosophy, if he had one? How did he become? How did he get from St. Petersburg to Moscow, to the Kremlin, to the prime ministership, to the presidency? And what does all of that journey tell us about the man now? How does it inform what he has become and what he is doing? So that was sort of the starting point, and so that's what we did. So as you've seen the film, so you know that the first part of it is very much about his early days in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, I want to get into that, but there's this central theme I wanted to ask you about, at least a theme that I identified as really critical in the film and in your investigation, and it's expressed by the renowned Russia expert Karen DeWisha, who is featured, of course, in your film. And it's this idea that people in the West have been misreading, maybe, the culture of Russia. Let me play this clip from the film, because I want to ask you about it. This is from the film Putin's Way.
I started thinking, instead of seeing Russia as a democracy in the process of failing, we need to see it as an authoritarian system in the process of succeeding, that they're not actually incapable of being Democrats. They don't want to be Democrats. What about that? Let's work on that thesis. And if that's correct, when did that start? And that's what took me to the 90s, because they were stealing from the very beginning.
How important is that idea from Karen DeWisha, that she points out that this is a bigger cultural thing, that really you have to understand what was going on in the 90s, I suppose, even before that. But that seems an important theme.
Yeah. And I'm not so sure I'd agree necessarily with the word cultural, but I think it is something. I think Karen was actually talking more to the idea that we had of what was happening in Russia, we in the West had.
Yeah.
And there was this, I think, a very simplified notion that when Boris Yeltsin stood on the tank and eventually became the president, that everything was over, you know, that Russia had seen the light, was going to fall into line with the international community, was going to become democratic and liberal and capitalist and all those things that we always wanted for it. And there wasn't really much more to be said. And it was, as we know, a very, very messy process that didn't ever complete itself. And I think Karen's point is we need to take off that sort of prism of idea that we've sort of placed on Russia and sort of look beyond that and say, well, we were the ones that said, you know, they're Democrats. They want to be Democrats just like us. We were the ones that wanted that. And what if we were wrong? So let's go back and look at history with that kind of notion. And you do start looking at things differently. You know, you don't sort of get this sense of a process that was hijacked along the way in some way by some bad people. You get this notion that it wasn't the process we ever thought it was going to be, and that we were in many ways the ones that were naive. Or in Karen's words, she talks about how we were sort of watching this with eyes wide shut because we had our own notions of what we thought Russia was going to become. And so then her she says, so if you look at it at Putin's rise that way, it becomes very interesting because she goes back and through all kinds of sources. I mean, she's a meticulous researcher. She documents those early days in St. Petersburg and the role that Vladimir Putin played in it. And of course, he was there in those early days as initially as the deputy mayor to the city. And more specifically, he was a chairman of a very important city council committee that controlled all the foreign trade in and out of St. Petersburg, a big port city. And that's where the corruption began, she says.
This is an important point. I mean, he's chair of this so-called Committee on Foreign Economic Relations. And as you point out, what's important about that, I guess, is he has access to or control over in some wells a lot of wealth and property here.
Yeah.
That's the point, right? I mean, this is where it starts.
Yeah. Well, if you remember back in those days, as the old system was collapsing, it was not surprising, I suppose, there were real problems. But one of the real problems they had was it wasn't clear that Russia was going to be able to feed its people. I mean, right. That the agricultural system was in complete disarray. The distribution system was broken. Harvests were not happening. Food was not getting to the stores. There were empty shelves. And so there was this sense of crisis. And so one of the first things the new democratically elected mayor of St. Petersburg, the first one in the city's history, a man by the name of Anatoly Sobchak. He had been, just to fill in the picture for those who don't know the history, he had been Putin's law professor in the 80s before Putin started his career with the KGB. And so when Putin arrived back in St. Petersburg after the collapse of the Soviet Union, he had been in East Germany with the KGB. You know, East Germany was no longer part of the Soviet Union. He returned home. He had no job, no prospects. He goes to see Anatoly Sobchak, and that's how he gets his job. In any event,
let me back up just to that point, okay. Because I think this is really important, because this relationship that he has with the mayor, Sobchak, is important, because this sort of becomes another bit, sort of another through line in your film, this idea of Putin being a protector, because others are taking note of the fact that Vladimir Putin takes care of Sobchak. And Yeltsin sees that as, I think I'd like that too, that kind of protection.
That's right, because that Sobchak administration, it was riddled, people say, with corruption allegations, let's say. And there were, in fact, a number of investigations into Sobchak, into Putin, into what happened to, the money that this particular committee was invested with to try to barter for food and to get food into Russia, into the city at that point. So it was it quickly gained a reputation as a very corrupt administration, very close ties to organized crime. St. Petersburg is at that time, and I think remains true today, has big organized crime families. And to get things done, frankly, in those days, one had to be able to work in the shadows, right. as people have said to us in the documentary. And Putin was very adept at that, whether that was by virtue of his KGB training, whether his experience working in East Germany. I don't know what the real answer is, but anyway, he was proven to be very adept. And so he became, in many ways, Sobchak's right-hand man for a lot of these schemes that were, some of which were investigated. Yeah. The thing was that eventually Sobchak loses the next election.
Right.
In part because, word has gotten around about the corruption. And then Putin is out of work again. And through a series of connections, he decides he's going to go to Moscow. And he lands himself a job in the Kremlin. It's fairly low, bureaucratic kind of job in the Kremlin, but he's there and begins, he's an ambitious man, and he begins his rise there.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually becomes not only prime minister, but then is named the heir apparent by Boris Yeltsin, right. Who is about to give up power. He has to constitutionally after two terms. And
Yeltsin knows that Putin will take care of his patrons.
That's the suggestion, is that, because nobody could, for the longest time, nobody knew who Vladimir Putin was, and why all of a sudden was he being named prime minister, right. and then being named the heir apparent. And the people who have looked at this and analyzed it, like Karen DeWisch and others, the conclusion they've come to is that the Yeltsin family at that time had real problems of its own. I mean, Boris was teetering his way to the end of his career as president. There was a big corruption investigation into the Kremlin at the time. People were vulnerable, and by people I mean family members around him, close aides, people who had profited from the whole privatization efforts in Russia. The rise of the oligarchs. I mean, that whole process was you know, corrupted in many ways, in many levels. I think that's well understood now. And so they were very much concerned what was going to happen once he was out of office. What happened if there was a successor? And the most likely successor at that point was a man who was a Yeltsin opponent, a man by the name of Primakov. Mm-hmm. And so they needed to put into place somebody that they could control, I guess you would say, or right. at least they would have some assurance was not going to come after him. And this is the theory, that they saw what Putin had done in St. Petersburg. He had protected Anatoly Sobchak when there were big investigations into him. At one point, he'd actually succeeded in getting him
out of the country.
Right. to avoid a police interrogation.
And so what seems thought, like well, a pretense of a heart attack, although as you point out in the film, he seemed pretty healthy a little bit later than that.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, he goes into questioning in the prosecutor's office and becomes very ill and then has to leave the country for medical treatment and then doesn't seem so ill after all.
Right.
But and in the film, as you know, it was Sobchak's widow that told us that story
right.
of how it was Vladimir Putin that arranged all of that. So he becomes the man that the Yeltsin family invest their security in. And you know, the history will show that the first thing that Putin did once he did finally become president was he granted Yeltsin and his family immunity from prosecution.
Right. I want to back up to Putin's time in St. Petersburg for a moment, because it seemed like an important thing to point out that Putin, if for the first time now, then this is in St. Petersburg, he gets some real authority. And there's some, as you said, some very serious problems that St. Petersburg is facing, and all of Russia is, as you mentioned, these food shortages. And it seems like the question here is, can he govern? You know, is Putin going to be able to fix the problem? So explain what happens next, because the fact is this food that he promises to the people never really materializes. And the millions, tens of millions of dollars that are supposed to go to that really disappears, this money, without
That's
a price.
Right. The arrangement was, because there wasn't a lot of currency around at the time either in Russia, so the arrangement was that a system was set up whereby Russian natural resources, oil, gas, metals, that kind of thing, would be bartered for food. And so there were people whose job it was, and this included Putin, who would go to Europe and they would strike deals bartering raw resources in return for food. Some of the food came back in. It's not like none of the food came back in, but a lot of the food didn't come back in. And there was an investigation that was done at the time. The city council, you know, this was apparent to the city council that something was wrong, and a woman by the name of Marina Salye started an investigation, and she looked into this. And for quite a number of months, and accumulated documents, many of them signed by Putin himself. And in our documentary tonight, Marina Salye has since passed away, but we had access to another documentary in which she had been interviewed, in which she goes through all of her documents. And her conclusion at the end of her investigation was that that crimes had been committed, that this case should be sent to the prosecutor's office, and at the very least, Putin and one of his assistants should be fired.
Right.
And that recommendation was endorsed by the city council, and it was overturned by Anatoly Sobchak. So nothing became of that. But it wasn't the only investigation that was No. going on. At the same time, there was a federal prosecutor who was looking into another scheme entirely, in which the city council was paying a construction company to build a variety of projects, and it became, you know, I mean, as these things often do, a whole plate of spaghetti of different sub-companies and various people involved. But he sort of made his way through that plate of spaghetti and came to the conclusion that crimes again had been committed. Some of the money had ended up in Spain building holiday villas for Putin and some of his closest assistants. And he wanted to arrest Putin. And he felt he had the evidence. He had a case that he felt he could make stick. And by the time that investigation worked its way through the system, Putin had already moved on to Moscow,
yeah.
and his political career was taking off there. And as soon as he became president, that whole investigation that might have seen this man arrested, and maybe history would have unfolded differently if he had been, but it quietly went away.
Of course, a lot of the charges that are raised in the documentary tonight, very serious. And I'm wondering what kind of reaction you are getting, or at least anyway expecting to get, from Russia itself, by the way, and Putin's representatives. Mm. Are you getting pushback yet? Because I'm guessing you will.
It's interesting, you know, because the program was broadcast in Canada on Friday. And so, I was sort of curious what we'd get. So far, there's been nothing. I can report that. So I don't know. It might be different when it appears on an American network. I think that, we certainly did due diligence in trying to speak with, get an interview with Putin or with one of his spokespeople. I mean, we had many long exchanges with the Kremlin and you know, they understood the documentary and the sort of the profile it would have. And at one point, we were actually fairly hopeful that they might come through. But obviously, in the end, they didn't. We do have a man who, you know, is authorized to speak on the Kremlin's behalf, answering some of the questions. So I don't know what the reaction will be. You know, it's I mean, and I guess there would potentially be two different kinds of reaction. I mean, you might have the official reaction, which would be the Kremlin, and I'm guessing they're not going to be pleased with this. Whether this is seen, you know, by Russians generally would be, to me, a more interesting question, because in many ways, you know, a lot of this was called from public sources. You know, these aren't state secrets that we're telling here. These investigations, you know, were talked about at the time, but you know, a lot that was a decade and a half ago. And since then, one of the things Putin has done very effectively in power is he has gathered the controls over the media, and you know, the Kremlin essentially. I mean, there's very very few sources of independent voice left in the media world in Russia. And so, you know, I some of this might be remembered by Russians because they may have been aware of the earlier investigations. But I'm you know, I think I can say with pretty good authority that they won't have heard or seen all of it. And it would be interesting to see how they might react.
Gillian Findlay is with us. She's host and investigative reporter for the CBC program The Fifth Estate, correspondent on the new Frontline documentary Putin's Way, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. For listings around the country, you can visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a provocative new documentary about Russian President Vladimir Putin. Investigative journalist Gillian Findlay is our guest today. She's been exploring Putin's rise to power for the PBS program Frontline and for the CBC. The film is airing tonight. In it, Findlay looks into Putin's ascent from his early days as a spy for the KGB into how he became a charismatic political figure and a popular leader. You should also point out the documentary is about these persistent accusations, though, of criminality and corruption. The film is called Putin's Way. It's premiering on PBS stations around the country. KUED Channel 7 is airing it tonight at 9 o'clock. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Gillian Findlay is joining us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. One of the really interesting parts about the film is how Vladimir Putin worked on his image. Now, there are a couple of interesting stories here. One is, and I think this was back in the St. Petersburg day, he commissions a documentary to be made about himself. And it was called Power, which is, that's that in of itself is pretty interesting.
Very telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
But also later he, and I think this was, you know, Yeltsin and others were trying to put a backstory together for Vladimir Putin. And they also wrote, they had this instant biography commissioned. Talk about that part.
Well, it was. It was commissioned by the Yeltsin family at the time, because once they had decided that he was going to be their man, they had to get him elected, first of all, and nobody knew who he was. I mean, he was literally the faceless bureaucrat. And so how in a country like Russia do you excite people about a faceless bureaucrat? And so they started by commissioning an official biography, and we interview in the documentary one of the three writers and that biography. And it's interesting that the purpose of the biography, she said, she was told, is that their issue was that he was a former KGB officer.
Right.
And at that time in particular, there was nothing more reviled in Russia than a former KGB officer. And so somehow they had to explain this to people. And so that was a large part of the document or of the biography, was to sort of explain, well, okay, maybe he was a KGB officer, but, you know, that was only because he was a patriot. And, you know, he has this really compelling backstory, you know, poor kid, grows up in a scrappy way, you know, wants to serve his country. That's how he gets involved in the KGB. And then, you know, the rest, the story takes off from there. So, the real motivation at the beginning, according to Natalia Gavorkian, who we interviewed, was they had to sort of get this KGB boogeyman off the table. And so that was part of the image making. So they do that. But that's helpful. But clearly what was needed, or what history will show was worked, was they needed a crisis. They needed something in which Vladimir Putin could be seen to be a leader. And that's, as we know, is what ultimately happened.
Well, that brings us to, I have to say, probably the most troubling part of the film, or certainly one of them anyway, these allegations related to the apartment bombings. This was in the fall of 1999 in Moscow. And as you point out, this really, to put it in context, for Americans, this was Russia's 9/11. And in many ways, this story really, really makes Putin in some ways. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely, it's fair to say. I mean, it was a sense of crisis, I can tell you, because I was there at the time. And there was a space of, I think, 4 days between in Moscow. Not all the bombings were in Moscow, but two of the biggest ones were. And I think there was something like 4 days between them. And just that sense of panic in the city, you know, when these all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, these apartment buildings just collapse in the middle of the night with people in their beds, you know, entire families dead, and there's no explanation. And so there really was, I think, you know, I wasn't in New York for 9/11, but I can imagine that people who were would recognize that sense of panic. But it wasn't just in Moscow. There were four of them throughout in different cities in the country, and so there was a crisis.
Right.
And he was prime minister at that time. He had just been named prime minister. He had also, prior to that, been the head of the FSB, which was the successor agency to the KGB.
Right.
And this faceless bureaucrat was all of a sudden everywhere on television, vowing that he was going to get to the bottom of this, vowing that the perpetrators would be brought to justice. And right from the beginning, very clearly pointing the finger at separatists in Chechnya as being the most likely culprits. And that, people will argue, people do argue, is what made Vladimir Putin president. It was unlikely that he would have won an election prior to that, but he became a national hero. He reinvaded Chechnya, brutal invasion, thousands of people died, and he became a national hero in Moscow and in Russia.
It seems like it could be argued this is something of a theme for Vladimir Putin as the Russian economy is experiencing real difficulties these days. I'm imagining some people are seeing what's going on in, you know, the invasion of Crimea, the redrawing of the map in Ukraine as the same kind of deflection to sort of change the subject, I guess.
And I think we should be fair and acknowledge that this isn't unique to Russia. This happens in other countries too. Sometimes, you know, a good foreign crisis is the best way to boost your popularity at home.
But of course, the film raises some very particular questions anyway as to whether or not Putin and others were in fact responsible for these bombings of these apartments. Tell us about that part of the story.
Well, initially, I think there was a general acceptance that it must have been the Chechen separatists. There had been a war under Yeltsin, the first Chechen war. You know, the fear of terrorism was real, and so there was, I think there was generally an acceptance that this was the explanation, but. Almost from the beginning, there were things that just didn't quite add up. And the thing that raised the most questions was an incident that happened in a city called Ryazan, which is, I think, about 150 miles outside of Moscow. And there was another apartment there. And one day, some eagle-eyed residents of that apartment noticed a couple of strangers carrying in sacks of something into the basement of that apartment. And so they quickly intervened, as it were, and discovered that the sacks that had been marked sugar in fact contained a chemical called hexagon. It's a military-grade chemical that was in fact identical to one of the chemical residues that had been discovered at one of the apartment bombings in Moscow. In addition to the hexagon, they discovered a military-grade detonator. Mm-hmm. And I suppose even more damning, the two people that had been noticed putting these sacks into the basement were eventually found and admitted to being agents of the FSB. And so at that point, the questions really started to be asked. Was it possible that the security services could have staged these terrible, terrible acts of violence that killed so many Russians? And if it was the FSB, for what purpose? What was the motivation?
Right.
And if it was the FSB, who was behind it? And there have been a number of investigations over the years, documentaries, newspaper investigation. Books have been written both inside and outside of Russia, but in particular inside Russia. And it is chilling, and we do this in the documentary, as you'll know, to list the people who had begun those investigations who ended up dead.
Right. One who is alive, Mikhail Trepashkin.
Trepashkin,
he dug, of course, into this story. But you tell about what happened to him. I mean, he was arrested, jailed for 2 years, kept going, wouldn't drop it.
Yep.
Jailed again for 2 years.
And jailed again.
Yeah.
Well, Mikhail Trepashkin was a former security service investigator himself, and he had been hired by one of the families of somebody who had perished in one of those apartment bombings because they didn't buy the official story and they wanted him to do an independent investigation, which he did. It wasn't easy because the bombing sites were bulldozed almost immediately. So, you know, there was no crime scene left. But he was diligent and he worked away at it. He came to the conclusion that these bombs were not the work of Chechen terrorists, but rather of the security services. And he was actually hauled in to an investigation. The parliament at the time, the Duma, had actually, there were some independent legislators at the time who were trying to conduct their own investigation, and he was asked to help them. A couple of days before he was to report to that investigative committee, he was pulled over at a highway roadblock in his car. Mm-hmm. He was, asked to step out of the car, and the next thing he knows, he saw somebody throw a bag into the back seat, and then another police officer reach in and open that bag and discover a gun.
Yeah.
And at that point, he was charged with the possession of the gun. He was tried. He went to jail for 2 years, as you say, he came out. He understood exactly what was going on. He came out and he talked about this. And on another pretext, he was thrown into jail for another 2 years. And he, you know, to this day, he feels badly that no definitive investigation has ever been done, likely will never be done. Right. But he is quite sure in his mind, you know, what this was all about.
Well, you mentioned three separate attempts in the Russian government to investigate this yeah. incident, all voted down, of course. You do
by the party in power.
Right, by the party in power. You do put this question to Putin spokesman Sergei Markov. You're pretty direct with him there. And he of course, dismisses the idea, but I wanted you to mention this. I'll put it this way, confrontation. You do raise the question of whether or not Putin or Putin's people had somehow been involved in all of this and in the investigations. What he says to you is this, that he tells you not to become a victim of propaganda. Mm-hmm. He says it's very dangerous also. And I didn't know what he meant by that. Did you take that as a veiled threat?
You know, it's funny. I didn't at the time, but when we were listening to it in the edit suite as we were putting the documentary together, I listened to it and it sort of struck me. You know, was he suggesting I should be careful for a particular reason? I don't think, in honesty, I don't think it was a veiled threat. I think what he was really trying to say was, you know, with any endeavor and an attempt to get to the truth, you know, don't get sidelined by propaganda because right. that will prevent you from getting to the truth. I prefer to believe that that's what he was saying. I think that is what he was saying. But, you know, when you put that up against the, you know, the Anna Politkovskaya and the, you know, the various other people who, journalists and others who have tried to investigate these events and met tragic ends, it does cause you to think, doesn't it?
Gillian Findlay is with us, correspondent on the news, the new Frontline documentary. It's called Putin's Way. Also, of course, a correspondent for the CBC. The program airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. For local listings and more information in your area, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. When we get back from a break, we'll talk a little bit about how a kleptocracy works. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with investigative journalist Gillian Findlay. We're talking about her remarkable new documentary, which traces the rise of Vladimir Putin and his power in Russia. It's part of the PBS documentary series Frontline. It's airing tonight on KUED Channel 7. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Gillian Findlay is joining us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. So I wanted to ask you about another kind of chilling moment in the film that you document. This was a meeting that happens in 2003. Vladimir Putin summons the country's oligarchs together. Mm-hmm. Give us the setting, because this is a remarkable moment too.
It is. It happened in St. Catherine's Hall in the Kremlin, a historic hall, this would have been the first 3 years into his presidency. Vladimir Putin had inherited the oligarchs, I guess, for lack of a better word. Right. They were a creation of Boris Yeltsin. Fabulously wealthy men, became wealthy, some would argue, many would argue, through a very corrupt process of privatizing off the state assets during the Yeltsin years. But nevertheless, there they were. And they were, for better or worse, the captains of industry in Russia at that point. And Putin had to decide, and they had to decide, were they going to work together? Were they going to work apart? You know, what was the relationship going to be? And we interviewed Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was the richest of them all. He was the chairman of Yukos, the oil company at the time. And your listeners, I'm sure, will know he's the one that spent 10 years in a Siberian prison camp when he ended up on the wrong side of Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
But he was at this meeting, and he said, you know, it was a very interesting meeting because he said, we thought that this was a man of what he called our generation.
Right.
We thought he was a modern man. He was of our age. And we thought that he wanted the same things we wanted, which was ultimately to obviously maintain their wealth, but to grow it and to use it to build the country and to move it closer to the West. And so they have this meeting in St. Catherine's Hall. And one of the big stumbling blocks, I think, in sort of facilitating that closer relationship to the West was the sort of endemic level of corruption.
Right.
And so Khodorkovsky tells a story of how he decides he's going to take this on. And he goes to the microphone and he says, look, and I'm paraphrasing here, but
live television, by the way? This particular moment? It was televised anyway.
It was televised.
Yeah.
You know what? That's a very good... I don't know that it was on live television, but it was ultimately televised.
Yeah,
and he goes to the microphone and he says, again, paraphrasing, we got to deal with this. You know, we got a big problem here. It's going to prevent us from, going further in the world. And let's figure out how we're going to do this. And at one point, and you speak about chilling, because at one point the camera then goes back to Vladimir Putin, who's listening to this, and you see this look on his face, a very steely look, and he says, well, let's not forget, and again, this is a paraphrase, let's not forget that your company, Yukos, has some problems with the tax department. Let's not forget that. Khodorkovsky, in retrospect, sort of realizes that was the moment that he was really in big trouble. He had called out in a public way the man who was in the controls of that system that he was criticizing. Now, Khodorkovsky was a problem for Putin in other ways. He was also supporting democratic political parties, the Soros Foundation, people like that, that were trying to bring new ways of doing things to Russia. And so but it was only, I think, 8 months after that meeting that he was arrested and ultimately sent to prison. His company lost his company. It was divided up between Putin's cronies, and he now lives in exile in Switzerland.
Right. It's interesting because, as you said, he figures when he first meets or comes in contact with Putin that he's a man of our generation. He's going to move beyond the old Russian style era, that is, of privilege and closed systems and bribes, and he's going to be but he quickly realizes that's, as you say, Putin's not that. Putin's of the old way. And I want to play another clip because this features Khodorkovsky speaking through an interpreter here, because he mentions another important theme in the film that Putin was, as he puts it, trying to create a model that he thought he could manage, but it really starts to kind of get out of control. Here's a clip from the film Putin's Way.
At first, he thought he could build a sort of a democratic model that he could control. A model like this does not exist, so he started to slide towards, at first, mild totalitarianism and then an increasingly harsh totalitarianism. If the situation develops further, he will reach a full totalitarian model. In reality, every authoritarian system is a kleptocracy.
That seems an important point, that because that is something that you get at in the film, is that Putin thinks he can manage it. He figures he can control it, but it starts to sort of get out of his control. Is that accurate? Is that a way to put it?
I think that, well, that is the assessment of people who've looked at this.
Sure.
The people like the Karen DeWisher and the Ed Lucas and the people that we interview, historians in the piece, that, he didn't necessarily set out to create what he ultimately created. But if you accept Karen DeWisher's argument that the corruption started from the beginning, then very much the imperative becomes protecting the gains of that corrupt system. And increasingly to do that, you have to become more authoritarian. That's the theory.
Right.
And that's what the allegation is, that, increasingly to protect the proceeds of the corrupt system that had been put in place, Putin and those around him, there are people around him as well, it's not just him, had to develop a system that they could control. And ultimately that leads to an authoritarian system. And then once that's in place, then, you know, as Khodorkovsky says, you end up with what he and others have called a kleptocracy.
Yeah. It's interesting because what you also explore just what that means, what a kleptocracy acts like, or the way it is. I mean, one particular moment, one exiled Russian businessman you talked to talks about how this system, I got a sense that in many ways it works a bit like the mafia. It depends on getting protection. Having a roof is the
having
term.
A roof, a Krishna. Yeah. Yeah. That's the term that they use. And very much so. And that happens at all kinds of levels. You know, as Karen DeWisha says, you know, if you're a member of the Duma, you know, you're paying off somebody. But then the flip side is that then you can demand payment from others. So the whole system, and they refer to it as a system, is built on that kind of protection. We also found the businessman Sergei Kolesnikov in Tallinn. I mean, it's interesting that so many of the people we interviewed actually live in exile.
Exiled, right?
but he was very interesting because he worked in the Kremlin. He did a lot of work. So he, for many years, was part of this system, and he actually with the aid of a whiteboard, he sort of laid out for us how that scheme that he had personal knowledge of worked. And it's, you know, it's very, in some levels it's very simple, but it's also very clever. And, you know, it's all designed, this particular scheme was all designed to take the profits of something that appeared to be a legitimate, even a charitable business of bringing medical equipment into the country, and funneling those profit margins into a bunch of myriad of other companies that ended up in a company that was ultimately, not, according to him, 94% of it was owned by Putin.
Right.
And, you know, where does all that money go? Well, in his particular scheme, and he's obviously only speaking about the one he knew, he was told that that money was used to ultimately build this huge palace that you may have seen photographs of around that. I think it was around the time of the Olympics in Sochi. It's quite clear to him that that palace was indeed, despite the Kremlin's denials, was indeed being built for Putin. And that's where the money was going.
$250 million, at least that's part of the allegation. The number $40 billion comes up as well as the possible estimated worth of Vladimir Putin. That's another extraordinary
And that was claim. A figure based in an investigation in 2007. So that $40 billion could well be much bigger than that now. And if it's true, and there were reports subsequent to that that the CIA confirmed the $40 billion figure,
yeah,
it would make him one of the richest men in the world,
right.
No question.
Of course, this brings us, and you come around to the conditions in Russia today, deepening economic trouble, of course. An economy pillaged is how it's put by someone in the film. Karen DeWisha sort of breaks it down in a perfect way, I have to say. She says the bottom line is reflected in two numbers. You want to talk about that because they're pretty startling.
Yeah. No, it is startling. And you don't necessarily see this when you're in Moscow, per se, because there is this veneer of wealth in Moscow, you know, and we can't forget that, you know, that there, especially due to high oil prices for the last number of years, that there is money that has serious money that has come in, that has started to trickle down. But she said her view is that you can take the whole country and you can analyze it through two numbers. She says the median or the midpoint wealth for the average Russian is $871. That's according to a study that was done by Credit Suisse. $871 means, this is her quote, half the population has more than that in wealth and half the population has less. And then she compares it to the median wealth in India, over $1,000. So the average Russian is poorer than the average Indian. That was startling to me when she said that. I mean, I'd never seen the Credit Suisse report, but I just thought, wow, that is remarkable. And then she gives another set of numbers. She says 110. There's 110 individuals who own 35% of the wealth in Russia. And by her calculation, that makes Russia the most unequal country by far in the world.
You know, I want to play one more clip. This is Edward Lucas, who's a senior editor for The Economist. He's terrific in the film. He says something that I think I hadn't really thought of, this idea that in many ways Vladimir Putin is trapped. He's sort of a prisoner in this system that he's helped create. Let me play this clip. This is Edward Lucas, again from The Economist, from Gillian Findlay's film Putin's Way.
There's never been a good succession model in the Soviet Union or in Russia. And he's very worried about how he will leave power. He doesn't want to leave in a coffin. He doesn't want to go to a jail cell. He has got so many guilty secrets, so much money's been stolen, so many people have been killed, that he doesn't really trust anyone to keep him safe if he steps down from power. So in a way, he's both the master of the Kremlin, but also a prisoner in it.
What do you make of that, this idea that in many ways he's created a system he can't get out of or change?
Well, it's funny because in some ways that's what we were saying just a little bit earlier about right. Boris Yeltsin as he neared the end of his term. Yeah. You know, he needed somebody that he could trust to protect him. And, you know, I don't know if there's somebody that Putin can trust to protect him. And, you know, it's especially with when you look at Russia today. I mean, oil prices are falling. The economy is, you know, continuing to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. The ruble is in free fall. The Western sanctions that we haven't talked about, but you know, there was, for a long time there was not necessarily agreement in the West as to what to do about his excursions into Crimea and other places. But now there's a sanctions regime in place that is starting to bite. You know, he doesn't the potential for problems for Putin, I think, are growing. And there was one analyst that we interviewed in the piece who talked about how important it was for Putin to watch the Arab Spring and mm-hmm. what happened to people like Colonel Gaddafi. You know, the idea that people really could rise up against an authoritarian leader, somebody who may have been seen as being unassailable. It could happen. And Stanislav Belkovsky is the analyst who makes this comparison. He says he believes that's why Putin actually did come back and run for a third time to become president, pushed Medvedev aside as prime minister, who had been president in the interim, came back. Now the constitution has been changed again, and so the terms are longer, and he can actually stay in power to 2024, conceivably. So he's got some years left. It'll be very interesting years, but I think it'll be very interesting to see, you know, whether he becomes the master of stays the master of the Kremlin or becomes its prisoner.
Gillian Findlay, she is host and investigative reporter for the CBC program The Fifth Estate, correspondent on the new Frontline documentary Putin's Way, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. For listings around the country, go to our website radiowest.kuer.org. Gillian Findlay, thanks very much for the time.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
I should mention we're premiering a new short documentary. A little bit later, we'll be launching it on Video West to look at a Provo-based photographer, Trevor Christensen, and his project called Nude Portraits, which is definitely not what you think. Go to videowest.kuer.org a little bit later today. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.